Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 1:26 p.m. That is Pacific Summer Time. Today is Friday, and it is May 24th. And of course, being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I'd like to relate to you a conversation I had with a subscriber during the week. And she has been a subscriber for decades and was expressing exasperation with the market that it was one of the more, it's currently one of the most difficult environments in which to plot a way forward. And she had decided to simply just stay in cash and just wait to see how things pan out. And that conversation has stuck with me all week. I've been really mulling it over. Because when we think about where are we in the cycle and what do we normally associate with major tops? Well, major tops are generally associated with mania. And there just isn't any evidence of mania in the market right now. We still have very low unemployment. We still have the leverage of the banking sector is less than it was. Where we can see that there are some signs of exuberance is in private equity. Private equity has certainly boosted the valuations of companies like Uber, Lyft, Tesla, Pinterest, those types of companies. So that is obviously somewhere where there is scope for some revaluations. We're certainly seeing that with Tesla right now. We also know that there has been incredible activity in the bond market, but bond prices are rallying. If we look at the 10-year Treasury future, it's still in a very consistent uptrend, and the ranges are similar sized. The one between June and March is almost exactly the same size as the one between the end of March and which was completed yesterday. So if we then start to plot what, or to predict, what will a consistent trend continue to look like, well, we could anticipate that considering there is a 2.5-point decline and there are 2.5-point advances from the breakout, then the next potential area of resistance is 127.5, and the subsequent pullback should find support around 125. That's simply predicting the consistency of, or predicting what can happen next based on the consistency of the trend we've been presented with. It's an example of a consistent trend is a trend in motion. In other words, what has come to pass already should continue to repeat itself as long as the imbalance between supply and demand that is driving the market remains skewed toward demand dominance. So then, of course, if that is not going to occur, it would tell us that that imbalance has changed. And the big question now is whether we're going to see this breakout persist. Because if it fails, if we get a failed upside break, well, then that would represent a trend in consistency, and it would then start to question the bullish hypothesis and what could potentially at this stage be a bullish consensus. There is the argument for bond bulls has become progressively more convincing the more consistent the trend has become. All the way back in October and September, people were talking about a very significant move downwards in yields and that the yield was going to 4 and potentially even 5% imminently. What we also saw this week was John Bullard from the St. Louis Fed saying that they may have slightly overdone it by raising interest rates in December. The bond market is pricing in 2 interest rate cuts this year. Well, we're at the end of May, so if they're going to cut interest rates twice this year, then they've only got half the year in which to do it. What we did see in here this week was that U.S. manufacturing data came in well below expectations. It was predicted to come in around 56, It came in at 52.8. So that is trending downwards. It's been trending downwards since August of last year. If it goes below 50, well, then we have clear evidence that the manufacturing sector is in contraction. Well, I've also put up some other PMI indices. This is the German one. So 50 is about there. It's currently at 44. German manufacturing is contracting. Then when we look at Japan, well, it was back above 50 at the last reading, but it contracted again this month. So Japanese manufacturing is contracting. And then when we look at China, well, it was contracting for the first quarter of this year. It popped back above 50. Now it's at 50.1. So China's manufacturing, having contracted, is an expansion territory just about. Although I think it is a bit of an exaggeration to say that. Well, this is what the bond market is pricing in. The bond market is not simply pricing in that the USA is going to cut interest rates, but rather that there is a slowing global growth, and that the slowdown in global growth is much more evident internationally than it is domestically. That is creating a bid for US Treasuries. Treasury yields are still competitive versus negative yields just about everywhere else. When, for example, we look at the German Bund, well, it is in negative territory by 10 basis points and coming down now to test the lows posted all the way back in 2016. What we are also now beginning to see is something that I've been suggesting for about the last 7 or 8 months, that it was inevitable that Germany is going to have to engage in fiscal stimulus. We are now starting to see that in this quarter. This is, I think, one of the most important potential outcomes of the European elections. The one thing that is unifying all of the populist movements in Europe is a desire to dispense with fiscal austerity. If they can achieve that, then we're going to see additional money flowing into the European economy, and I don't think anyone is under any illusion that it is badly required. The Euro Stoxx index has been ranging below 400 for the better part of 20 years. And when we start, well, below 450, I should say, it is now right in the region of the trend mean. If it's going to bounce, then this is exactly the area we need to see that happening. When we look at the banking sector in Europe, then it has been in a base formation for much of the last 8 years. It pulled back sharply over the last 3 weeks. It has broken its sequence of higher reaction lows. There are continued worries about the ability of a number of the largest banks on the continent to remain viable. But nonetheless, this is only going to further enhance the potential that the ECB is going to re-engage with monetary easing. Whether that is in the form of quantitative easing or whether they try something else is still debatable, but the size of the balance sheet has been going sideways for the last, well, since the beginning of this year. There is, I think, ample scope for it to expand. The ECB's own forecasts are for it to contract. There is almost no possibility of that happening against a background where you continue to hold to the fiscal austerity regime. On the other hand, if they dispense with fiscal austerity, there is the potential for a transition to occur in Europe in much the same way that has occurred in the USA. So the outcome of the European elections is potentially going to be transformative for the supply of liquidity for Europe in particular. So one thing is to worry about the various bearish scenarios. Well, when we think about the fact that global economic growth has been weakening, then we know what the causes of that are. There is obviously the trade war. Then we have the fact that the Federal Reserve has been tightening policy. They've been raising interest rates and contracting the size of their balance sheet simultaneously. And now that is starting to feed through into economic figures with the expected 6 to 9 month lag. So that's why we're starting to see these kinds of figures coming through. Well, we also know what the potential solutions are. So the Federal Reserve can stop reducing the size of its balance sheet. Well, they've already committed to doing that. They're going to stop in September. But they may be encouraged to stop earlier if growth figures continue to contract. Then, of course, we have the question of the trade war. What we have to begin to consider is how much of it is brinksmanship and how much of the measures being taken and suggested are part of a wider strategy. So that is the big question. What I think investors had been willing to consider was that it was all brinksmanship and there was going to be a deal sooner or later. Well, people are starting to come around to the notion that the aim of the tariffs is simply to have tariffs. It isn't about economic growth. It's not about the fact that we have the supports for manufacturing as a result of the tariffs. We can already see that manufacturing is starting to contract, so there's no argument there. But perhaps it is more an overt attempt to foment nationalist fervor, or to simply create, or to move on from the promise of economic growth. And the next logical step is to boost nationalism. This is the first and last resort of populists of every hue. They just go through and boost nationalist fervor in order to ensure that people start to think less about the economic welfare of the country and more about their emotional needs. Well, we saw that happen this week in India. Narendra Modi is the first of the populist leaders, and he has won a resounding victory in the recent election. And Rahul Gandhi has already conceded defeat. But what I think is most telling is that the BJP had engaged in lots of small projects out in rural India, which had been appealing to large numbers of regular people, whereas the Congress Party has almost always been an autocracy, which is quite elitist and then nepotistic as well. So there, the contrast between the two visions for the kind of people that the regular citizens can vote for has been drawn very clearly in the Indian election. And because India was the first country to be taken over with a populist message, it gives us a good example of what we can expect elsewhere. When we think about what's happening in the USA, then the advent of cross-party support for sanctions or tariffs on China is something new. One of the things that the Democrats have been using to criticize Donald Trump is that he hasn't been hard enough on China. So that is, I think, a rather new scenario. It's something certainly that China had not anticipated. They are still trying to find their feet because they couldn't understand how this could happen so quickly. But the reality is that the trade war has been going on for about 15 years already. If we go all the way back and think about the fact that Google had exited China as a result of the demands that were being imposed upon it to share data, then that was the beginning of the trade war. But you can't have a trade war unless you've got two people. So basically, over the last 15 years, China has been able to take advantage of the fact that the USA took its eye off the ball, particularly following 9/11, then following the credit crisis, so that now, after a lengthy period where living standards have been deteriorating, and not only because of the imbalances as a result of quantitative easing, but also because of the denuding of the economy of the middle income jobs that were particularly represented by manufacturing. Well, what that is now contributing to is the rise of populism, then potentially nationalism. So that is certainly a potential outcome, particularly as we move towards the election next year. So when that is begin, I think we start to take that into account. If it comes down to nationalism, then the aim of the tariffs might well be simply to have tariffs, to create a more antagonistic global environment in order to boost nationalist fervor, and then to ensure that he can win the next election. That is a real potential outcome. Well, then, when we think about the hardening of attitudes that China has had, the big questions outside of the market are just how much the Chinese are going to be willing to support their, excuse me, support their currency. It was in positive territory in here today. It's been unchanged for the last six trading sessions, so there is clear evidence there of them attempting to support the currency. Well, of course, they are doing that, and by selling treasuries. So when we think about the quantity of treasuries that US that China has, it has been contracting, and one of the things that they're using with that money is to uphold the value of the renminbi. The one problem that China fears more than anything else is capital flight. The fact that a quarter of all dwellings in China are vacant, that's despite the fact that you have a population of 1.3 billion people, is a serious misallocation of capital. Then you have the fact that we simply have no idea, and more importantly, we don't have any way of finding out what the natural default rate is. Now, we know that defaults have been rising and that they are up over 300% from last year, but we don't know where the terminal point is for this rise in defaults. So that also represents a challenge. Then we also know that manufacturing is not expanding in an encouraging fashion. What all of this is pointing towards is the clear need for both monetary and fiscal stimulus. And if we start to think about the kinds of things that are providing liquidity to the global market, well, there are three. There is the capacity for China to engage in fiscal stimulus, and they have been doing that. It was 500 billion last year. So that's the big question, whether that will continue. Then we have the strength of the US dollar. Now, what was particularly interesting yesterday was that on a day when stock markets were weak, the dollar posted a downside key reversal and then followed through on the downside in here today. Well, that is another short-term peak, and now it is likely to come back down and test its sequence of higher reaction lows. It was responding to that weak manufacturing data. The clear potential here is that we are at the cusp of additional monetary easing, and in fact, we're going to have to see that. We're going to have to see an additional source of liquidity coming into this market. The weakness of the dollar, a weakening dollar, would be that it could unwind short positions in a large number of currencies. What I found particularly interesting in here today was if we look at the Asia dollar index, then it has come all the way back down to test the lows from 2018 and 2017, and it bounced. And there is a clear short-term oversold condition evident here. If we look at the Singapore dollar, then we also have evidence here that it has found support in the region of last year's lows. And the Taiwan dollar has also found some support in here. But these are short-term oversold conditions, and they're going to have to do more than simply unwind those, but they'll have to strengthen further to truly question the dollar's dominance. But there is potential that with the impending end of quantitative tightening, that will remove a potentially important tailwind for the dollar. And that's another interesting fact that we had in here this week. Gold prices steadied up yesterday, and they were steady in here today as well. There has been a great deal of ambivalence expressed towards the gold market. I've seen targets for $850. The number of people that are predicting that it is going to imminently surge through $1,400 is, you could probably count on one hand. If the dollar does begin to weaken, then that is going to represent a rather significant tailwind to gold. Then, of course, there is the ongoing need for some form of financial hedge. Because if we do get to a point, and I think this is perhaps the most important point, we know that there is slowing economic activity globally. That is perhaps the number one thing to worry about. We still have low unemployment, we still have the US economy growing, but with slowing global economies, then that's something that is out there on the horizon that is potentially something worrisome. Now the big question is, how quickly are central banks going to act? If they act in the short term, then and preempt a further slowdown in global economies, then the market will start to look through the current economic figures, and we are likely to see asset prices starting to rise once more. If, however, they continue to wait and they go through the end of the year without cutting interest rates, then that means they're going to wait for an actual contraction before they start cutting interest rates. Well, we know that then it takes about 6 months for those interest rate cuts to take effect, and that's generally speaking when you start to see stock markets taking fright, when they both raise interest rates too much and then wait too long to cut them afterwards, is when you get what is logically the equivalent of central bank mistakes. So gold is, I think, a good hedge against that potential, because following the next mistake that central banks make, and it's inevitable that they're going to make a mistake sooner or later, then that is likely to usher in the advent of modern monetary theory. I don't think that there is anything to be gained by having a lengthy debate about the merits of modern monetary theory. It is, as anyone who has even a modicum of common sense knows, that you can't simply print money with no longer term consequences. But that's irrelevant if that is the direction in which the market is going to go. Well, if we do then see that kind of inflationary bias, bonds will not be a particularly beneficial place to be, but gold will be a better hedge because you can't simply print it into existence. Real estate is also something that cannot be printed into existence, and Bitcoin prices have also perked up. Well, Bitcoin is being used as both a hedge against the devaluation of the renminbi, and it is one of the primary vehicles for capital flight from China. The vast majority of Bitcoin mining happens in China. It is essentially a Chinese cryptocurrency, and it was firming through the 8,000 level in here today. There is also this potential for catch-up with some of the altcoins, and Ethereum has been firming within its range over the course of the last couple of weeks. Well, or I should say the last week. What this also highlights is these are the kinds of assets that cannot simply be printed into existence. They are outside the control of governments. They also represent the uncorrelated assets that are attractive to fund managers pursuing a modern portfolio theory strategy. The one thing that makes modern portfolio theory work is uncorrelated assets. One of the big problems with it is that over the course of the last decade, we've had one-to-one correlation in just about all asset classes. Therefore, the advent of custody services for cryptocurrencies is a major departure. It is something that is a clear change, and it opens up the cryptocurrency market to institutional investment. So that is, if we enter to think about what a bullish catalyst is for the sector, that's definitely one of them. Then there is the additional point that Facebook appears to be very much intent on launching its own cryptocurrency. I'm very much reminded of the history of the gold rush or the diamond rush in South Africa. It was alluvial miners were the first people to mine gold in California or diamonds in South Africa. But I guess the difficulty of mining became more intense, and the capital requirements for mining became more intense, that attracted in bigger investors, and they bought out the old claims, or they took over the old claims, and then dominated the business. That's certainly the case in California. It was also certainly the case in South Africa. And I guess if you think about 10 years ago, people could mine cryptocurrencies on their own home computer. Then 3 years ago, we had the advent of ASIC machines, so they dominated the mining of Bitcoin, particularly in China. But now we have major companies with what are effectively limitless resources that are now coming into this market, and they have the clear potential to dominate it because they have incredible resources to throw at programming and development projects. So there is a clear potential here for Facebook to take a big piece of this market, and not least because they have 1 billion users. So that is a very significant market into which they can sell their products. It's also potentially a major benefit for Visa and MasterCard, because they're going to take a piece of this market. And what I find particularly interesting is that these kinds of companies have been performing admirably, but on a relative basis, they've been knocking the lights out. Now, there is absolutely no doubt that this is short-term overbought here, but the relative performance of these kinds of shares has been nothing short of stunning. So there is obviously a clear move here in terms of fintech. And there is also a move in terms of the rise of the subscription business model. When we start to think then about what exactly is going on here, are we at a major peak, or are we at a medium-term correction? Well, I think it is important to simply look at the charts. The S&P 500 has been ranging for a year and a half already, and it has unwound at part of the overbought condition relative to the trend mean, and it could yet pull back below it, but it did the same thing in 2015 and 16. This is certainly a larger pullback, so we do have to express more caution because of the size of the pullback. I think it is also worth paying some attention to the logarithmic scale chart. because when we start to think about log scales, and particularly over the course of this bull market, well, we know that there have been significant periods when medium-term corrections have found support in the region of the 200-week, not day, but week moving average. And I think that is something that's rather interesting, that on a log scale basis, this is a large medium-term correction, and there is potential that it will go on for a while longer. But in order to really demonstrate that this bull market is over, it would need to sustain a move below the lows posted back in January of 2019. Now, that's a big move from where we are right now, but it's an inconsequential move relative to the size of the advance put in since the early part of 2009. And we are still in medium-term corrective phases. What's also particularly interesting is if we look at valuation, then the PE on the market today is not all that different from where it was back in 2015. It's certainly not back at the values that we had in the 2000s. So we've had a meaningful correction in terms of valuations since the end of 2017 and all the way through to the end of 2018. And that valuation has not rebounded in the same way that the stock market has. So I think it is arguable here that there is potential for the market to push higher if investors have a good reason to. What we also know is that the yield on the S&P 500, oops, that's the wrong chart, excuse me. The yield on the S&P 500 is 1.97 right now. And the yield on the Dow Jones is currently around 2.27. Well, if we think about US 10-year treasuries, there has been a very significant move into when, so right now we only have a 4 basis point differential. But one thing I've certainly observed in the various relationships I have is that there has been a very large drive into the cash, and people have been more than happy to roll over cash balances at 2% or 2.25% or 2.5% because they were uncertain about the market environment. Well, the yield on the 2-year right now is 2.16%, and that is easily exceeded by the stocks in the Dow Jones. It's really not that far away from where we are with the S&P 500. There is an increasingly good argument that investors can start looking at stocks instead of bonds for yield. And that's something that generally tends to create demand for stocks. So we do have the valuation, and we have the yield rationale for why people might want stocks. I think that's one of the most underappreciated but potentially most powerful rationales for why this market is not at a major top yet, but is potentially just consolidating, and that this is a lengthy medium-term consolidation. Now, we are also in the third year of the presidential cycle, and in the first half of the third year, we generally get a growth scare because following the election and the kind of spending that goes on to ensure election, then the Federal Reserve starts to tighten policy, and it takes a while to take effect. So by the time you get into the first half of the third year, it is taking effect, and then they start easing, and you do get a medium term, or at least you get a sharp pullback at some point in the first half of the third year before things start to settle out again, and then you get a significant rally. Generally speaking, it is the fourth year of the presidential cycle provides the best return? Well, we're halfway through, or not quite halfway through, the first half of the third year. We have seen that the Federal Reserve has been tightening policy. They are starting to line up around the idea that they've tightened policy a little too much. That's what Bullard was saying. Then, when they start to ease, provided they can do it quickly rather than waiting, then this market has potential to rally from here. If we do start to see Trump taking more sensitivity with regard to the outlook for the stock market, which does appear likely because despite the clear intention to spark nationalist fervor within the US population, he is also very much tied his presidency to the performance of the stock market, and that is going to have to continue to do well if he wants to get re-elected. So what we are probably at right now is an ebb in terms of the rationale for a trade negotiation, but that does not mean that we're not going to have another one. These negotiations have ebbed and flowed, and there is likely to be some form of negotiated settlement that he can sell as a victory before the next election. Now, when we look at this trend in terms of yields, well, there was a clear failure in around the 3% level, and this is still a consistent downtrend. We know what it's going to look like when this trend ends, but it does have certainly got the consistency behind it to suggest that there is potentially another leg on the downside here for the 2-year Treasury. What I think was also particularly interesting in here this week was the pullback in oil prices. It was down over $3 in here today, and it was up 150 in here yesterday, and it was up 150 in here today. This is the region of the trend mean. It's a much bigger pullback than we've seen so far this year, and what it does suggest is we're in for a more volatile period. It is likely we're going to get more volatility the closer we get to $80, because a lot of additional supply becomes economic at $80. So that's, I think, something that we have to be prepared for. But one of the, I think, more important points is if we look at the broad measure of what commodities are in fact doing, then we had a higher reaction low in here today on the continuous commodity index, and it is beginning to demonstrate some support in the region of the 2017 lows, and it's been largely range-bound for more than 3 years. Copper prices are one of the things that people are paying particular attention to and are worried about. But it was in positive territory in here today, and it has been pulling back over the course of the last 2 months. And now the big question is that despite the short-term oversold condition, is it going to be able to push back above the trend mean? Are we in a period where this is a distribution below a type 2 top, or is this a consolidation? This is the question that people are asking, and I think that we are due a bounce. The bigger question is, once that bounce is complete, will it be able to push back above the 280p level, or cent level, I should say. But this is not the only commodity that comprises the continuous commodity index. Nickel today had a rather dynamic move. It was up 51 cents. And when we look at the intraday chart, it just went straight up off the open. So what this is beginning to suggest is that there was some short covering underway. What I also find particularly interesting in here right now is that lithium prices have had been trending down for most of last year, but they have stalled. And there is potentially base formation development underway here. Well, they were at 160,000 renminbi a ton back at the end of 2017, and now it's at 66,500. Now, when we look at cobalt, then we also get some, I think, rather interesting intelligence here, because that was also very bubbly looking back in 2018, and it appears to be finding support around the 30,000 level. So we have nickel starting to do better, and evidence of slowdown in the decline in lithium and cobalt prices. Well, all of those correspond with battery demand. And one of the things that has been most talked about in terms of Tesla has been slowdown in demand for its cars. Well, it was in negative territory again in here today. And this is a company that benefited enormously from access to cheap credit. And that the downside is now continuing to be explored. So some of the varnish has been brushed off of the intangible assets of the company. And it's now right in the region of the lows put in between 2014 and 16. So if it's going to bounce, this is about where that needs to happen. Otherwise, we're talking about the real possibility of it being either going bankrupt or being taken over. The one thing it does have, though, is the Gigafactory. But it's Panasonic owns everything inside the Gigafactory, and Tesla basically owns the building. Well, Panasonic has also taken a dump in here over the course of the last couple of weeks, and it's now right in the region of the lows from 2016. There are a significant number of the lithium miners have also been pulling back in here this week. So SQM from Chile is also accelerating down at this stage. There are, I think, some big factors that are sitting out there for the battery sector. One is that battery chemistry is super hard, and the pace of innovation in battery technology is not as quick as people want. Then you have the slowing Chinese economy, and the tariffs are certainly not helping that. So that is impacting demand for batteries. Then you have the cost, and electric vehicles are generally more expensive than internal combustion engine vehicles. So these are headwinds that will probably be dealt with over the medium term, but they are not being dealt with in the short term, and that does represent a challenge. That is one of the benefits that Tesla has, that they do have cars that are in the region of $30,000 to $35,000, and that is cost competitive for a what is effectively a desirable car. But the bigger question is whether they have lost the faith of investors. Now, when we also look at the agricultural commodities, we are seeing evidence of a return to demand dominance. Corn prices are back above $4, and this is a very well-defined range. We know that there has been a cyclicality, and that the peaks here have occurred in June and July of every year within this base. So the bigger question is how much damage has been done to the winter crop, and we are going to find that out within the next 6 or 7 weeks. If we look at wheat prices, then there is the potential here for additional upside as well. It has been able to push through the trend mean and confirm support around the $4 area. Soybean prices are also starting to rally from here, having retested the $8 level. Oats, and I have a bowl of oats steaming in front of me, are going to are also looking stronger. And when we look at that on a weekly basis, this is another range that has persisted for the medium term. Rough rice this week broke out, and the USA is one of the biggest exporters of rice, so that is the conclusion of a 7 or 8 month range. Well, What this is also suggesting is that we've had some very bad weather in the Midwest in the first part of this year. Planting has been delayed. There may not be a winter crop in a significant portion of the Midwest. There is the scope here that a floodway for the Mississippi will be used, and that could flood parts of rural Louisiana over the coming weeks. There are a significant number of refineries in that area, so that is potentially a bullish characteristic for gasoline prices, and gasoline is consolidating following a short-term overbought condition. Well, when we then start to think about the fact that yes, oil prices have been weak this week and they are now moving into a more volatile period, and that copper prices have been lower. Well, we then can also look at the fact that these aren't the only commodities out there. Iron ore, for example, remains in a very clear uptrend. So Chinese steel demand is still a significant factor. And agricultural commodities are steadying up. It isn't simply the grains and beans, but if we look more at internationally dependent commodities, cocoa prices pushed on to new recovery highs in here to break out of a 7-month range. And despite the fact that cocoa has been, excuse me, that Arabica coffee has been one of the worst performing commodities over the course of the last few years, we're starting to see just nascent evidence of some support starting to come through. And more importantly than that, it has broken the sequence of lower rally highs in here today, but it wasn't quite able to hold that move. And all of these are pointing towards that while we certainly have growth worries, and that is weighing on copper, that if we take a big picture, broader perspective of the commodity complex, the number that are making new highs outweighs the number that are making new lows. And that is supportive of an inflationary bias. That is also supportive of global demand. There is the potential that we are still in a medium-term corrective phase. I think when we start to add all of these arguments up, what we have is a great deal of uncertainty, because we have all been conditioned to look at the market from a fundamental basis, or from a macroeconomic basis, or from a technical basis. But people are unaccustomed to looking at the market from a political basis or a geopolitical basis, because we didn't have to. We basically had world peace after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and that period is now over. There is the realistic possibility that the relationship between the USA and China is in terminal decline. The simple fact of the matter is that China has essentially bitten the hand that fed it. There was technology transfer over the course of the last 20 years. Deng Xiaoping's mantra was to play nice and hide your strength. That exact same strategy was pursued by Jiang Zemin. But after he was, or at least when the next premier took over, that policy ended. And China has become much more assertive internationally. There has obviously been a very clear decision made in Washington that if the USA doesn't do something to erode that those international hegemony ambitions now, then it will be too late in future. So there is scope for a trade negotiation, at least to placate the economy in the short term, but it's unlikely that we are ever going to go back to a situation like what we had before the trade war. The advent of nationalism is about as polar opposite to globalism as we can imagine. And that's something that is going to get priced into markets eventually. It's certainly likely to be a powerfully beneficial fact for India in the short term, or at least in the medium term, because it is the kind of thing that can get the economy starting to move again. It can get some of the intransigent bureaucratic movements blasted through. But more importantly than that, India has really become more of a counterbalance to China in the Asian region, and it is a beneficiary of migration of manufacturing from China. I think that we are still in a medium-term correction. There is the potential that I'm wrong and we will not get a trade deal, and then the market will pull back below the trend mean. It will exceed the lows put in January, and then we will be in a bear market. But until we start to see true rolling over, and most particularly when I think about the very large cap shares within Wall Street, which have been the clear leaders, then Amazon, for example, is unwinding a short-term overbought condition, but this has not yet broken below the trend mean. Netflix, which is another one of these companies that has benefited enormously from access to credit, is still consolidating above the trend mean. Microsoft, which has undergone a renaissance under Satya Nadella. Whoops, that is not the right ticker. Has been able to storm through to new high ground, and it looks like it's due some consolidation, but this is still a very clear uptrend. There is the potential that we are still in the third psychological perception stage of this bull market, and that there is another significant leg on the upside merited before we start to see some of the practices that have led to some excesses in the market, particularly in private equity, particularly in intangible assets and misallocation of capital, and then also the massive debt burdens that have been taken on not just by companies but also by governments. What a lot of people have been anticipating was that that would happen last year. It certainly has not. The continued contraction in government bond yields, in fact, bolsters the argument for why people should be looking at income-producing equities. There is the clear potential that we are just in this medium-term correction. That is, I think, really supported by the Dow-gold ratio. When we think about the very long term, there is the clear potential that by the time the secular bull market has ended, that this ratio is going to be in excess of 40, and that we are going to have had the delivery of massive sources of technological innovation, that there will be a true space economy, that we will have autonomous vehicles before this bull market has ended. We will have incredible advances in biotechnology, and every one of those is going to create massive sources of wealth and accumulation in terms of asset prices and stock market performance. Well, if that is indeed the case, then we can anticipate that yes, we are going to have recessions and that they will be wonderful buying opportunities. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.